You are now listening to The Real Enneagram, a podcast by the Institute for Conscious Being. To learn more about the Institute and its offerings, visit theicb.info. That's theicb.info. And now, here are your hosts, Dr. Joe Howell and Nanette Moodyum.
Well, welcome back to The Real Enneagram, a podcast brought to you by the Institute for Conscious Being. I'm Nanette Moodyum, and I'm here with Dr. Joseph Howell. Hi, Dr. Joe.
Hi, Nanette. Glad to be here with you today.
Nice to be here with you, too. It's mutual. That's always nice. We're going to be talking about chapters 6 and 7 of our journey here into Becoming Conscious, the Enneagram's Forgotten Passageway. And chapter 6, interestingly enough, is titled The Secret Passageways of the Arrows. So this idea of passageways and movement of the Enneagram was something obviously you kind of latched onto even in the title, Joe. So today, as we talk about that and talk about that movement of the Enneagram, we're going to be looking at disintegration and integration. Mm-hmm. So just as a maybe a kickoff, let's start there. Let's sure. Start with disintegration and what that movement looks like and what does that mean?
I think when you brought up the subject of the hidden or secret passages, the reason that it is hidden or secret is that the flow to integration in the Enneagram is not obvious. Because you have these arrows. And actually, if you're going to integrate from your ego type to your soul type, or some people call it the heart point, you have to go actually against the arrow that is pointing at your ego type's number. Mm-hmm. Actually, for simplicity purposes, there are two arrows that are at each ego type on the Enneagram. One arrow points to our ego type. The other arrow goes from our ego type to another number. So if you're going to integrate, which means that your consciousness is rising, that you're more adept in living life out of your ego traps and avoidances and passions, that you are going against your arrow to another number whose positive and soul qualities are how you were born. Mm-hmm. That's how you came into the world. But you forgot that. You were disconnected. We all forgot our original goodness because the world shakes our cage. I mean, when you're a little child and you think your body is beautiful and you want to walk on the street, the sidewalk without a stitch on, thinking that that's wonderful and okay.
Yeah.
Somebody's going to shut down that parade. Mm-hmm. And what does the little child think? The little child thinks, oh, I'm not so beautiful. Oh, something is wrong with my body. Oh, I need to cover myself up. Mm-hmm. And that is the installation of shame. Early, early shaming. So that's how we got to our ego. The ego is a reaction to having been rejected as our soul child. It's simply a psychological reaction that is so important because it's the mental structure that saves us from the rejection, the cruelty, the anger, the fear of this world that we are all in. And that's what egos do. Every ego, every one of the 9 egos have their own approach to anger, fear, and shame, and any other thing that can really rattle us, discombobulate us, make us feel unworthy. So integrating, we go against that arrow, meaning we are integrating into our original being, which is our soul. But to disintegrate, we follow the arrow that leads from our ego type's number and goes to another number on the Enneagram. Mm-hmm. In this case, when in disintegration, we're going to the aberrant qualities of that number in what's called the stress point. That's at the end of the arrow that shoots from our ego point. And at our stress point, we are much more fragile, and we give in to our passions, our avoidances, our traps much more readily, because it's easier to go to our stress point. Even though it's called a stress point, it seems like the most obvious answer.
Yes, you're going with the flow of the arrow, right?
It's like...
like gravity.
Yeah, like gravity.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the other one, integrating, is harder because you're going against the arrow. But a beautiful image there, Nanette, is salmon swimming upstream. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. They're going against something.
Yeah.
But they're returning to where they were born.
Yes. Yes.
Isn't that interesting?
Yes.
So all of this is called the inner flow of the Enneagram.
Okay. Can you give an example of that, maybe in a number? Like, so let's just start at the top of the Enneagram. If we just said, how about 9? How does that look in integration and disintegration?
Well, the 9 actually was born as a soul type 3. And that was what the 9's soul child was. It was a little 3.
Yes.
Who was out there accomplishing, outspoken, really wanted to be maybe the life of the party, motivating, glamorous, or attractive in some way, just like threes are. And they got shut down, like I just said. Mm-hmm. For the 3, so the soul child of the 9, I imagine a scenario of their being shut down was when they tried to accomplish something. Mm-hmm. They tried to build something. They tried to be successful at something. They tried to win at something, not for ego motivations, but because their soul was successful, accomplishing, a winner, and a prototype for somebody who got things done. Mm-hmm. That's not egoic. That's part of the solality versus the personality. And that's nuanced, and we may need to get back to that.
Okay.
But so you have this little child, for example, let's say she went into the woods near her house, and she built a little house, and she put her dolls and or action figures in the little house, and everything was beautiful. She built it on her own, and she asked her older brothers to come and look at what she had made, because she was so absolutely proud of it. And one of the brothers laughed, and the other brother kicked the house down. And the deflation that she would have felt, because these insensitive, not much older children than she, did something out of their own reaction to this thing they experienced, that had much more of an effect on the young 3 soul child. Actually, it was, you call it the 9's soul child at 0.3.
Okay.
And she may have become shamed. She may have become angry. Mm-hmm. She may have become fearful. She may have become to feel that she's inferior. And what did that little soul child do to cope? She put on an ego of a 9 that says, I don't care what happens. Do anything you want. Say anything you want. I'm okay with it all. Nothing affects me, good, bad, or indifferent. I'm kind of asleep to all that may affect me negatively, and for that matter, positively. I'm just going to sleep on life. I know how to cope with all this.
So if you are out there and you're thinking about this soul child, is it the case that everyone remembers their soul child? Or do some people put on an ego earlier or later than other children?
Well, to your point, not everybody remembers their soul child.
Okay.
From the hundreds of people I've interviewed and who have come through our institute and attended conferences, I would say as many as 20%, sometimes maybe pushing 25% of people don't even remember their childhood. For some reason, because of trauma or a lot of moves or some kind of abuse, or some kind of reason they disassociated from their childhood being because of threats, etc., and unhappinesses, they have blanked most of it out. I mean, they may know where they were born and their brothers and sisters and their parents, of course, but having very quaint memories of what they did and how they moved in the world, they don't have ready access to that.
Okay. It's interesting to me that I always think about disintegration and integration kind of like shoots and ladders. You know, it takes some effort. It's very easy to disintegrate because we just become kind of the worst of ourselves. And we're all good at identifying that normally in our lives, but the integration, the work that it takes. And very often these days, you know, we kind of refer to people who do the work, whether if that's therapy or if that's spiritual practices or exercise or whatever that is for people who do the work in their lives to heal and to become better versions of themselves. And it seems to me that it almost correlates with this work of integration. And would you speak to the practices that maybe contribute to integration? Because as soon as we find out that there is a point of integration, we want to know how to get there. Right.
Thank you for bringing that up. People usually don't integrate as part of their first nature. When we're living in our egos, we want out of the trouble that our egos have caused us. For example, 9, she or he has gone to sleep on their life. They are anesthetized as a way to cope with all of the difficulties that life brings all of us. Sometimes the word self-narcotization is used because they do everything they can through foods and social relationships, through their own movement through the world to forget. It's called self-forgetting. And, you know, it is almost like a high. You just drift around and you don't have this identity. And if it begins to come to the fore, so to speak, this identity, they self-abase in order to discount themselves. Because if they come to matter, 9s, if they come to matter, then they've got an opinion. And if they have an opinion, they may voice it. And if they voice it, they get into conflict. And that if they get into the conflict, then they have to touch the seething anger underneath that really is underneath 9s, 8s, and 1s, all of those in the gut or body center of intelligence. So what 9s do before they go to integration is what all egos do. before they go into integration. They say, I think I know how to get out of this. So they begin to maybe wake up, but as soon as they do, they go back to sleep again, and they are awakened by their own panic and fear. What happens is, to the nine, they have gone to sleep on life, but they're beginning to have nightmares in their sleep.
Okay.
They're beginning to shake themselves awake that the house is burning. Mm-hmm. And what happens is they go very quickly, following their arrow from 9 to 6, they go to the very, very unhealthy aspects of ego 6, which is being consumed by fear and anxiety. It's as if their bed that they've gone to sleep on has caught fire.
Uh-huh.
And it scares the living daylights out of them.
Mm-hmm.
So they are in an awful state. They don't have a voice, but they're petrified. They can't express their anger, but they're on fire. They are pleasant people, but they can't be pleasant anymore because their fear sucks the life out of them.
Mm-hmm.
So it gets so bad that they either follow the arrow from 6 to the unhealthy 3 and then back to the 9 following the arrow, which they arrive at themselves in a much less conscious state than when they began.
Mm-hmm.
Or they say, I can't stand this suffering. I'm going to search for some relief in some way that works.
Yes.
And George Ivanovich Gurdjieff used this word in opposition to self-forgetting. It's self-remembering.
Yeah.
And when any ego can self-remember their soul or their soul types, their soul qualities, they are then going against their arrow to their origin, to the soul that they were born as.
It's so interesting that you followed this line of thought, because I wanted to ask you, is disintegration ever good? And it almost is sometimes, if that might be the final thing that wakes you up. You know, if disintegration, if your life finally really falls apart and you get to the worst of it, maybe you begin to wake up. So there are gifts even in disintegration, and in the movement of the arrows, that there is a path for anybody at any stage. So that's so beautiful. And in talking about that, Joe, so we've talked about what it means to integrate and disintegrate based on our 9 example, but can we also talk about what the arrows mean as it concerns our wings? So the numbers on each side of you, what is that movement like?
Yes, it's very important.
Okay.
By the way, I didn't want to go out. Miss your question about what do you do to from your ego type to your soul type.
Okay.
I thought that was a very good question, and most people don't even ask it or give that much thought. In the Institute for Conscious Being, as you well know, because you're on the faculty, we teach how to do that.
Yes.
Which makes our organization a very unique one, because it's not just teaching the principles and the history and philosophy of Enneagram and the technology of the Enneagram. We teach the application of the Enneagram's first purpose, which was for spiritual growth and discernment.
Yes.
I mean, this thing is a divine thing, not a mental construct.
Yes.
So, having said that, spiritual practices are the most efficient, wonderful, and grounded way to make it from our ego to our soul type. And spiritual practices can be an array of, well, it's never ending, but some very well-known spiritual practices that get us back to our soul are meditation, contemplation. Oddly enough, the labyrinth, which if you've ever studied it or tried it, you know the magic of what the labyrinth does to place us right in the middle of that labyrinth and what happens to our psyche and our soul when we stand there in awe. Centering prayer. Thomas Keating has done so much wonderful writing on the centering prayer aspects. Drawing mandalas. Susan Fincher wrote a wonderful classic book on mandalas as ways to find our inner selves. When people do dream work, it's another example of the soul work that takes us back to our depths, which is where our soul is. Our dreams come from our depths, and they have these amazing images and these amazing stories to teach us about our true nature and what we're dealing with in our current life and our past and possibly our future. So dream work is huge. Need I go on? The list continues. Music, art, collaboration, inquiry with other people, which is an art. Self-inquiry without another person, which is an art. Active imagination that Robert Johnson explained from his having worked with Carl Jung and has written about in his own work by that name. So we have a treasure chest of ways we can find our soul.
Yes.
And to your point about people who have forgotten their childhood, the happy point that I'd like to make is that we have helped in the Institute many people come to know their soul child once more.
Yes.
Even as simple as having a picture of them as a little child, with or without their family, having family albums to go through, talking to family members about how they were at that age, and also guided meditations that, in a relaxed and safe way, take people back to the spring of their lives.
Yeah, it's beautiful, beautiful work to do that. So, well, I'm going to circle you back. I want you just to give just a few points on the wings, because I don't want to miss that before we close out today, Joe.
Okay. The wings. It's a very important aspect of the primary understanding of the Enneagram, because actually every ego type has an ego type on the other side of it, which means it has two other ego types that have been called its wings because a bird has two wings and you can't fly without both wings. I'm very amused that when I look at Facebook posts by certain people who are talking about what their types are and what their wings are, they always say, I am a five with a four wing. But they don't understand that what they're saying is they only have one wing. And they're probably really saying that the four is their dominant wing. But if it is, then fives have another wing called six that may not be their dominant wing, but it is a wing.
Yes.
But what is a wing? It's another ego.
Okay.
It is an alternate ego that we can slip into and out of, sometimes at will, sometimes unconsciously. It is a way to operate in the world, just like our ego type is, with its own strengths and its own weaknesses. I remember Don Rizzo and I taught the medical residents at the medical school at the University of Alabama. We were talking about wings. He had only written one book by then, and the Enneagram Institute had definitely not even been formulated. And I said, Don, what is your thought about these wings? And I'll never forget, he said, they make me understand how complicated life is and how busy life is, because both wings also are susceptible to integration and disintegration. So you have three egos doing a lot of work all the time. This is rarely mentioned.
Yes.
But if you think about it, we are not that simplistic that we have one ego with eight characteristics that integrates into eight great characteristics or disintegrates into eight bad characteristics. That's too simplistic.
We're much more complicated than that.
Yes.
Yeah.
For example, I mean, I don't mind telling this, that I am an ego six. I like to operate in nine because that's my soul type. But I'm aware when six is operating in me. I sense it. I go, aha, there you are.
Uh-huh.
There you are.
Yeah.
And I laugh about it or cry about it because it's so pitiful at times. The negative aspects of it are. But I have this wing seven, and it is my partier, my comedian, my traveler, my love of different foods and dancing and exploring and adventure and no pain.
And a corny joke every once in a while.
Right. And a corny joke. More times than I want to admit. But, and then I have this other wing that is my five wing. And that's my studious, reflective, introverted. I have an introverted five wing. Not all fives are introverted, but the one I have is.
Okay.
And I can go to the monastery, any monastery near here, and check in for a few days and be completely happy alone and walking and contemplating and reading and maybe, you know, doing lauds or complines with the religious and just enjoy the fact that I'm unplugged. Now, the person at the monastery who is me is completely different to the person who is traveling to India and is savoring all the different cities of India and talking with all the different religious leaders that I can talk to and gathering information and tasting and seeing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I'm involved in life totally in that seven wing, and I'm involved in a deeper aspect of life in my five wing. Well, my sixness, my ego, is actually an amalgamation or combination of my seven and six wings.
Such an important point, I think, for our listeners to know that, yes, that they really are both of their egos that are next to them. Yes, and such a great point.
And if you look at your ego, if you want to describe your ego, you just look at how you meld the ego type before you and after you on the Enneagram or on either side of you on the Enneagram.
Yes. And so sometimes even that wing that we don't acknowledge, or we might even call that our shadow, right? I mean, I realize, unfortunately for me, that many people who kind of press my buttons are very often people who have my shadow number, which I would call eight. But it's interesting for us to consider. And it really speaks to the dynamic that we are all the numbers of the Enneagram, right? They're all in us. We have a capacity for movement in and out of all of them in some way, right?
Yes. There is a place in Atlanta, Georgia, and a very, very large city. Of course, it was a major city in the Civil War and in Sherman's March to the Sea. It was destroyed. And the Battle of Atlanta is reconstructed in what's called the Cyclorama.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it's over in Atlanta. I urge anyone who is in or through Atlanta to go through this because it's almost like being in a living IMAX,
mm-hmm.
because your seats turn and you actually see in the round the Battle of Atlanta done in relief, in sculpting.
Mm-hmm.
It was done, I believe, in the 1930s,
mm-hmm.
but it has been kept up and it is absolutely beautiful. And by the time your seats turn all the way around, you have experienced the Battle of Atlanta. I say this as an example of our lives are made up of different vignettes of when the different ego types were operating in us, and all of them do.
Mm-hmm.
Also, and this is a little bit advanced, but also every soul type of the Enneagram is in all of us as well. So we have many different types of cycloramas.
Well, it means that there's a lot for us to reflect on and to continue to learn from the Enneagram. So thanks so much for sharing with us today, Dr. Joe.
Thank you, and I enjoyed it.
Thank you for listening to The Real Enneagram, a podcast by the Institute for Conscious Being. To learn more about the Institute and its offerings, visit theicb.info. That's theicb.info. The music for today's podcast was composed and performed by ICB faculty member Drexel Rayford.